I'm here with James Grady and Keir Graff, editors of Montana Noir, as part of the Montana Book Festival. To begin with, I want each of you to describe the collection using three words. Keir, you get adjectives. James, you get nouns.
Why don't you give us a hard challenge as writers here? That's pretty it. I get three words as nouns. I would say people, Montana, challenge.
Can you dig deeper?
Sure. But can I use more than three words?
No. Three words relative to this specific collection. I'm thinking like guns, methamphetamine.
Well, I'm trying to keep a three-word limit. Really, I would say crime, love, and consequences.
What about you, Keir?
Dark, diverse, contemporary.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Keir Graff and James Grady, editors of Montana Noir, an anthology of short stories including works by Thomas McGuain, Gwen Florio, Jamie Ford, Deborah Magpie Erling, Sidner Larson, and David Abrams, among others. Stay tuned for a lively conversation about the darker side of Big Sky Country. This program contains adult language and themes. Listener discretion is advised. I think most public radio listeners are familiar with noir from the parody sketch Guy Noir from A Prairie Home Companion.
That may be true.
First, I'm going to give you the definition that I found from the Oxford Dictionary, which is, noir is a genre of crime, film, or fiction characterized by cynicism, fatalism, and moral ambiguity. How would you, each of you, describe noir?
Well, I would leave off the crime because James Cain wrote Mildred Pierce and The Postman Always Rings Twice. Both of those are noir classics. And in Mildred Pierce, the only crime is the daughter, you know, stepping out on her mother's rules. So I think that noir is, in terms of an entertainment function, goes far beyond the guns and guys and dolls and malls.
Yeah, I think we've been defining it often and probably not consistently as we've been traveling across the state, but we often talk too about how the stories tend to be about people who are forced with making difficult choices when there's no good option. There's no really right choice. There may be a choice that is the kind of least bad choice. I often tend to think of noir too as depicting individuals in struggle with society, often fighting against forces they kind of dimly comprehend. I think noir definitely is about feel and atmosphere, for sure. It's one of those things it's hard to define, but you know when you read it.
So what about Montana makes it a natural context for noir?
Jim and I have been, as we've been riding around all week, and particularly this morning, we were sharing a lot of noir stories, true tales from Montana, the dark side of Montana that we both really know. Montana is a place where there's a lot of economic hardship. And when you have people who are desperate anywhere, bad things happen. And, you know, I left Montana originally looking for opportunity. I mean, Jim, it's a similar situation. People, I meet people all the time who say, you know, why would you possibly leave a place as beautiful as Montana? And my somewhat glib reply is always, you can't eat the scenery. And yet Montana is filled with people who have come here for the scenery and then find themselves struggling to make a life. And desperate people make desperate choices sometimes.
I think it's also really key that Montana is actually the birthplace of noir fiction. Dashiell Hammett wrote the first noir novel based on Butte in the early days of the War of the Copper Kings. It's called Red Harvest. For probably legal reasons, he changed the name of the city to Personville, but it's Butte. It is still in print now, almost 100 years later. It is the standard by which most noir fiction is judged, and it is Montanans.
James, on your Wikipedia bio page, it claims that You're a bookish cinephile who also enjoys the study of Tai Chi, swimming, and listening to prog rock. I want to know, are these last three hobbies, are they reprieve from or inspiration for your espionage writing? Well,
I think they're kind of a merger. You know, the public schools in Shelby were good when I was there, but my true education was at the Roxy Movie Theater and that my dad managed at the Toole County Library, that my mother was an assistant librarian. And on good days when I could drive out to the rim of town, getting KOMA, Oklahoma City, 50,000 watts of rock and roll. That was where I grew up. And it just, all those influences, they keep propelling my life. And the rest sort of keep me vertical.
Who's in charge of the radio dial on your travel?
That's an excellent question. We alternate.
Seriously?
Yeah. Oh, we negotiated. You know, we got XM and Cure's iPod, and we negotiate that.
Jim's been pretty good about asking to hear some of my selections.
Thank you.
And tolerating them with good humor.
Thank you more.
What do you know about your own relationship to the dark side of being human?
I'll let Cure think. I kept thinking I was growing up in a father knows best world until I got to be about 11 and realized there was a brothel on the edge of Shelby. I started to see other things. And then when I went back to Washington and after working for Senator Metcalf, which was an amazing opportunity, I became an investigative reporter for syndicated columnist Jack Anderson. My job was to look into organized crime, espionage, any kind of corruption I could find. And after about 4 years, you find yourself really steeped in a different perspective on walking down the street than anyone else. My wife still says, no, don't look at those guys and wonder if they've got a gun.
I should have really answered that question before, Jim, because it's hard to top that.
Yeah.
While he was pounding the pavement for Jack Anderson, I was the editorials editor for the Hellgate Lance newspaper. It's not quite as tough a beat. Growing up in Missoula, when I did in the 70s and 80s, you know, it was a very free-range kind of childhood, something that's sadly really not available to my own kids in Chicago right now. And we went everywhere unsupervised, and being kids and being inquisitive, we found ourselves in a lot of situations that I think I would shudder to imagine my kids confronting, and yet those helped kind of shape my worldview and teach me what was outside the front and backyard of my home. I mean, we used to swim in the Clark Fork River, and we wandered through hobo camps. With friends, we used to, you know, poke in and around alleys and abandoned buildings, and you encounter, you know, Missoula's always had a certain, you know, whether it's the bikers coming up to, you know, Luke's in the top hat, or, you know, the kind of sidewalk and alley culture. I mean, there have always been some kind of hard cases around the corners of Missoula. And from an early age, I kind of had a sense that there were people who were experiencing something that was a hell of a lot rougher than what I was.
All right, James, also referred to as Jim, will you read the first couple pages of your story?
Sure, I'd be delighted to. One of the things that we were talking about Montana and its struggles, one of the timeless struggles that has always both appalled and encouraged me is the struggle of Montana women. And it's taken many shapes and forms. You have Jeanette Rankin being the first woman ever elected to the United States Congress. In the 60s, you have some of the most progressive legislation for women's reproductive rights ever being introduced by Dorothy Bradley. In the Constitutional Convention, you had that same struggle. And at the same time, I grew up in a town with a brothel, which was probably a step above slavery, but it wasn't a big step. That age-old struggle, the age-old exploitation of women continues now with these weird phenomenons of traveling bands of strippers. And when I heard that and I researched it, I just thought, I gotta go there. I gotta show my hero is a woman. And that, plus Shelby, that took me to my story, The Road You Take. Let me read a little. A big blue sky arced over that prairie highway, driven by a lone white minivan. Roxy rode behind Desiree, who'd called Shotgun, when they left last night's motel in a pine trees in Good Money Town across the mountains. Shotgun meant riding next to Bear, 300-plus pounds of watch-out crammed behind the steering wheel. He stank of weed he wouldn't share, cigarettes, and whiskey. Plus, you might catch a paw if he thought you sassed, or he simply got the itch to pop somebody. But Desiree packed 60 extra pounds of flesh on her 5'8" and stiletto heels frame, and the big girl knew how to take a hit. Cherry rode on Roxy's left, past the cooler, behind Bear. Her golden blonde dye job had more class than Desiree's motel sink peroxide. Cherry craned to see where they were going, as if there were some destination besides the next gig. She was a few high school years ahead of Roxy, who wondered if somewhere under heaven there was a letter or email inviting her real name to her class's 10-year reunion. That notion made Roxy sort of laugh as the white van rumbled her life away. "What's so funny?" mumbled Star from the way back, where she rode slumped amidst suitcases, sound system speakers, cables, mini spots, makeup and costume bags, telescoping dancing poles, and the deflated ring for oiled-up bikini wrestling gigs. "What isn't?" Cherry arched her back to stretch. Potholes on this two-lane highway across the top of the state rattled the minivan, but Roxy saw no tremble in the breast some surgeon built under Cherry's red sweater. Roxy thought, wonder if Cherry paid back the loan plus VIG Luke fronted her for that work. Wonder how much longer I can keep him from helping me go under some knife. Star said, nothing funny about one of you skimming my stash. Not me, said Desiree, and no way it's Bear. Crystal make his heart fart. Whoosh came Bear's backhand toward Desiree. Missed because a gopher ran across the road. Made him swerve the minivan and messed up his aim. Almost, said Cherry of the attempted varmint murder. Star, Luke's rules say no rips, no holdbacks, so there's no thieves in this ride. Bear growled. Don't go talking about Luke. I'm road boss, and no more you asking to drive or some what the f*** you want, cozying up to the man. I'm just trying to stick my place, said Cherry. Roxy said, nobody's skimming you, Star. You could tell. Tweakers, no tweakers. So far, Star steered clear of the needle and pipe, only sniffing. She kept her high cheekbones, tawny-haired stop-traffic beauty, her teeth, and her tight TNA, no tremor in her pony legs when she stripped. But her eyes were always black holes. Catch some sleep, Roxy told the beauty in the way back. Sleep is when they get you, said Star. You can really get got when you're tweaked, said Desiree. Don't care, then. Desiree stared out the windshield. There's a whole lot of out there, out there. The western third of the state was the Rocky Mountains marching down from Canada, pine tree crags soaring more than a mile above sea level. East of the mountains meant scrub grass prairies and chessboard brown and gold fields of rotated crops, which if you weren't born there, looked like one terrifying big empty.
If you're just joining us, that was James Grady reading from his short story featured in the Montana Noir Anthology. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the next segment, we'll be discussing mermaids and misconceptions about Montana. Don't go away. What's your relationship to the Big Empty?
That was where I was born and raised.
How does it sit in your soul?
It's there. I am completely conscious every day of that vast prairie, big sky, wind howling emptiness and how it's really not empty. It's full of hopes and dreams.
One of my favorite lines in the book comes from your story, which is when your main character is in Shelby, and you write, "She did what you never do in a small Montana town, walked." And I have to tell you that I actually had a friend get pulled over by the cops in a small northwest Montana town because it was such an unusual activity to just walk.
Right.
Why is walking so foreign?
I think because when you're up there and the wind is blowing and it could be 40 below at noon and, you know, 40 above at 7 o'clock at night, the freedom and the shelter that a car represents is so important. And of the two, probably the freedom more. You always feel like you can just go even if you can't. Walking, you're stuck from horizon to horizon.
I want to bop down to southeast Montana, to Billings. Billings, Montana often gets a bad rap. It's like the Houston or Dallas of Montana. And two of your authors have very different approaches to Billings. And I'm actually going to ask each of you to read their little fragments, and then we can talk about it. James, will you read Carrie LeSueur's take on Billings?
The streets of Billings drew her in, as they always had. They were homey, small-town streets. Even with the population topping 100,000 these days, full of people who smiled and said hello, even to strangers.
And Kira, will you read Walter Kearns?
Yeah. Oasis Pizza never closed. It was open all night and it delivered anywhere. That was its edge, the way it stayed in business. Unlike the shops that belonged to national chains, it served the grimmest parts of Billings, from meth lab motels to pit bull trailer courts to dirt floor shanties by the river.
Different sides of the same coin. How would you extend this to Montana in general?
Well, I think what you see in Montana are lovely, wonderful homes and smiling people in the streets. And you turn the corner and there are three obvious victims of either the OxyContin infestation that's just, I think, really beginning sadly to hit Montana, or the meth infection, which has been poisoning and troubling the state for a decade now. You go from one side to the other in a blink of an eye or a turn around the corner.
Yeah, and it's often, as Eric Heidel might describe the distance, it's often a rifle shot away from the boutiques of your, you know, downtown Bozeman's to the desperation of the trailer court.
I was just going to talk about Eric Heidel. So Eric writes about the Sip and Dip in Great Falls, which is this notorious hotel bar, has this piano player, Piano Pat, and mermaids that swim in the tank, which is actually just the hotel pool. And if you come at the wrong time of day, you'll just see families and legs of preteens. But at night, there are mermaids. How do you think, or how did you know, each of you, or you think of the authors in general, to use the unique charms of Montana without overdoing them, you know, like Glacier National Park or geysers or mermaids in a tank?
You know, it's interesting. We gave the authors kind of our wish list, our things we hoped that they might do with their stories. But one of the things we did not do was, say, include any natural or national landmarks or any tourist stops or anything that'd be easily identifiable like that. I think that most of the job of editing an anthology is done in the selection of the writers, knowing the right people to ask and then trusting them to do the job. And I think that most of our authors just had the right sense of how much to include and how much to leave out. Eric told us there was no way he was going to write a story set in Great Falls without including the Sip and Dip because he thought he might be run out of town if he left that out. But other writers in other places made different choices. I think we really ended up with the right balance there. But yes, of course, the Sip and Dip had to be in his story.
And speaking of Eric's work, and this harkens back to your story, James, which is one of my ongoing gripes about writing the West is how often female characters are hollow, one-dimensional sex object plot devices. And I found myself really surprised and relieved when I read Eric's piece about his portrayal of Amy, who is a woman with dementia and these real Montana skills, which in my experience is part of what it takes to live in Montana as a human, but as a woman. And I wrote him a note and he wrote back and says,
Yeah, well, she has her shit far more together than Chance, who's the leading male character, and I suspect she's earned every bit of it. So, James, in thinking about your piece, did you consider this trope as you were writing? It sounds like you did because of what you mentioned. And how did you work around it or with it?
I just chose to try and show that it was just that. I was raised by five strong women. And to try and reduce a Montana woman to a mere sex object or the entity that brought coffee is it appalls me. And it's an insult to all the wonderful women I know here and everywhere, to my mother, my aunts, my wife, my daughter. And I wanted to not confront that with a speech, but really to show these women who are in the most desperate phase of their life, all struggling in their own way to get out. And yes, they're sort of the ultimate sex object on one level. They're strippers, but they all have brains, heart, soul, dreams, hope, and fears.
Kira, anything you would say about this topic?
Apparently, I avoided the subject by not including any significant right. women characters at all, which was not a choice. It just happened.
Well, let's get into your story. Will you read the first couple pages of yours?
Sure. So when I was looking for a topic for my story, which I was kind of originally a contributor to the anthology before I got promoted to co-editor, which was an exciting development, I knew I wanted to write about fire because when I was growing up, it was an occasional event, and now it's become an annual event. And given that my own trips home to see family occur late every summer, they're a part of my every experience with Montana now. And I chose the site of my fire, Lolo Peak, somewhat at random, partly in conjunction with a certain local landmark. And when Lolo Peak actually caught fire around the middle of this summer, I just had that weird, eerie feeling that somehow my writing had done something. well, as I keep saying at readings, I promise to use my powers for good. Sid breathed hard as his shoes crunched the gravel. He thought, you can't outrun smoke. He'd woken early to run his 8 kilometers before the sun rose above the mountains and began to scorch the brown hills of the Bitterroot Valley. He loved the quietness, broken only by the scree of a cricket, the twee-twee of a bird, the distant burr of an engine on the highway. After only 2 years in Montana, he was still unused to the exhilarating joy of being alone. The cold nights, too, gave him a thrill, and it was a pleasure to be awake when the first rays of sunlight topped the mountains to warm his skin. On a normal morning, the light would have had a lovely violet tint. Today, it was just brown. Smoke from Idaho wildfires had been drifting east for more than a week, dimming the stars, blunting the sun, and, if the way he was gasping now was any indication, infiltrating his lungs. Exercise in such foul air was probably worse than no exercise at all. He worked phlegm out of his throat and spat, laboring toward the Y in the road where he usually turned around. He had grown up in heat and humidity, the air dense with smells of food, flowers, and garbage. He had come here to get away from all that, but he had not known about the fires. Sid had been told about the renewing qualities of fire, how forests needed to burn so new growth could emerge. Some pine trees actually required the heat of a fire to release the seeds from their fallen cones. Old brush and dead trees became ash so green shoots could emerge on the forest floor. He read about fires in Canada and Siberia that might not burn out until they had exhausted their tinder. He knew about rising temperatures, thawing permafrost, and melting ice caps. And Montana was so dry that the Forest Service fire danger signs seemed permanently set at very high and extreme. He wondered whether there came a time when the old rules ceased to apply. Reaching the Y, he jogged a circle in the road, his trainers puffing dust as fine and arid as Martian soil, and turned back. Most of the road was monotonously straight, but a curve and a drop here, combined with the robust fringe of knapweed on the bank, made it a blind corner for cars coming up from behind. Sid heard gravel popping under the truck's tires before he heard its engine, a throaty V8. He stumbled into the weeds and pressed himself against the bank. The black truck pulled up next to him, its window down. The driver leaned forward and shouted across a gray-bearded man in the passenger seat who was concentrating on something in his lap. Wear some lighter clothes, asshole. The man had mirrored wraparound sunglasses resting on the bill of his baseball cap. Sid looked down at what he was wearing. Navy t-shirt, black shorts, blue running shoes. Should he apologize? "I'm trying to save your goddamn life." The man gunned the engine and the truck sprayed gravel and surged forward. A pebble stung Sid's shin like a wasp. It wasn't until the white GMC on the truck's tailgate had disappeared around the bend that Sid started running again, shakily, wondering whether the man would have said anything about his clothes if his skin hadn't been dark as well.
So we learn that Sid is Siddhartha Ghosh, an immigrant from Mumbai, India. And I'm thinking now about Northwest Montana being a hotbed for neo-Nazi and white supremacist activity. How do we define insiders and outsiders, and how did you know that you wanted to write from this point of view?
Boy, defining insiders and outsiders. There are a lot of different kind of outsiders in Montana, but, you know, I mean, there are a lot of white outsiders who, you know, are setting themselves apart, whether by living in compounds or living off the land or just living an alternative lifestyle. And Montana is certainly a lot more multicultural than it was when I was growing up, wonderfully. And, you know, Missoula, having the university here, certainly has always drawn a lot of people from all over the world. And I was fortunate, growing up a couple of blocks from campus, I was fortunate to grow up with a wealth of cultural opportunities and meeting people who broadened my horizons, because the kids in my school classes were homogenous, for sure. But through the university and through some of the cultural events, I was exposed to a larger world out there. And the choice of having Sid come from there, in particular coming from Mumbai, was, I mean, this is a story ultimately about climate change and about the environment. And, you know, maybe it was just a too neat, dramatic pairing, but given that he finds himself in the dry, arid, continually burning place, I was just casting about for something that felt like the opposite of that. And thinking about the floods that the people of Mumbai had faced, it just kind of sprang unbidden.
And in terms of the arc of the book, why end on this story?
Well, I think it's probably the most apocalyptic story, with the vision of a fire starting that would never stop. You know, it goes a little bit beyond the kind of intimate conflicts of some of the other stories, just pitting a couple of characters against each other or a group of characters. This is human versus human, but also human versus nature. And I think that for me, certainly, I mean, I don't remember how we decided necessarily, but I think it was a very brief conversation. I think it was like, should we put it at the end? Yep. The line about the fire starting that would never stop, I think just felt like a
closer.
Felt like a bleak ending to a bleak series of stories.
James Grady was born in Shelby, in Keir Graf in Missoula, Montana. Look for more information about Keir, James, and Montana Noir at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.